Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1 with Allcare Pharmacy. Sign up to our loyalty programme and reap the rewards at Allcare Pharmacy, Ireland's largest community pharmacy network.
Good morning, you're very welcome to the show. Our panel are here ready to put order on the chaos of the world, but we'll have a look at the front pages of the papers first. So the Sunday Times is leading with no citizenship for refugees. On welfare benefits, refugees, Jennifer Bray writing, will not be allowed to become Irish citizens if they have received welfare payments within a certain time period or if they have any debt under sweeping new immigration reforms due to be considered by the Cabinet this week. The Sunday Independent is leading with a, quote, stampede. Now, that's in the words of one estate agent. A stampede of landlords leaving the market over new rules. And these are rule changes that will give renters who sign agreements after March 1st 6-year tenancies and ban small landlords from putting their properties on the market without tenants being left in situ. They're saying that this is the number of landlords leaving the market is accelerating ahead of that. The Business Post is leading with that. They are saying that the cost to Dennis O'Brien of that court case he lost this week could be a 2 million bill. That's when you take into account legal costs and everything. The Mirror is leading with the funerals yesterday of 23-year-old Chloe McGee and Shane Duffy, who both killed in that horrific car crash in Louth last weekend. And the Sun is leading with Big Joe Egan, a boxer, insisting that his close pal Gerry Hutch would be the most honest politician in Leinster House. And the Sunday World leading with Monk on the run again. Hutch tells pals he will definitely run in by-election for Dáil seat. Our panel this morning, Catherine Pacifica is an author. Larry Donnelly is a law lecturer at the University of Galway. Brenda Power is a columnist with the Irish Daily Mail and the Sunday Times. And Pat Leahy is political editor of the Irish Times. Good morning, everyone.
Good morning.
Morning.
Brenda, you just said there during the news that the man who we won't identify who died in that car accident was a friend of yours.
Was a friend of mine. I've known him since he was born. I babysat him. And I suppose in the week when we're talking about a horrific spate of road deaths, it just brings home how this is a tragedy that hits. This is something that hits so many families and so many communities on a near daily basis at this stage. I just want to say he was a lovely, lovely man.
Yeah.
And I'm beyond heartbroken for his family.
Yeah. Getting that news. Yeah. OK, so that brings the reality of that home for us. Will we start today, Pat, with just before we get into the big issues of the day? Niamh Horan has an interview with Gráinne Shorga in the Sunday Independent where she says running for election, she ran for Fianna Fáil in the last general election, is the biggest regret of my life. It's a salutary tale for anyone thinking of getting into politics, isn't it?
It is, yeah. It's a good piece by Niamh Horan, who's really good at these type of interviews. And and she talks about her regret is not because she didn't win a seat in Galway West for Fianna Fáil, but because of the experience of running for election, the sort of treatment that she had to put up with online, which involved videos, circuit fake videos, pornographic videos of her done, I presume, by AI, which were circulated widely and, as she says, continue to circulate. So the whole experience seems to have been a pretty miserable one for him. I mean, I think it tells us a couple of things about how our politics and broader public life operate. It tells us about the abuse that politicians have to put up with. And we've discussed it in this studio before, not just politicians, but it's especially sharp for politicians and because politicians by their nature put themselves before the public. And it also tells, I suppose, the corollary of that is how tough you have to be a politician. Now, you really have to be mentally, psychologically, robust, I think, to put up with the amount of abuse that you will necessarily get.
There's an interesting piece in your own paper yesterday about the generation of Fine Gael politicians mainly, who all got out early. Like, it does seem in a way that there people can do this now, or people are saying, I can do this now for so long. It's a part of life, a part of a career. But actually, it comes to a point where you go, enough.
Yeah, that's right. Harry McGee did a piece for us yesterday, and he was reflecting on the aftermath of the departure of Pascal Donoghue, which I guess we'll go on to,
we'll come to talk about.
But if you think about it, you know, 5 years ago at the 2020 general election, the new generation at that point that was coming to lead Fine Gael, having taken over the mantle from Enda Kenny and Michael Noonan, that generation was led by Pascal Donoghue, Simon Coveney and Leo Varadkar. All are now gone from Irish politics. Now, I do think that it's not necessarily a bad thing that political careers maybe shorter.
Yeah, yeah.
And all of those three guys got into politics when they were relatively young. But there's no doubt that what politicians have to put up with on a daily basis, and you talk to any politician from any party in Leinster House and you hear the same story. I think that is something that will shorten political careers, some of which we might prefer we're not short.
And presumably Catherine Pacifica will also, if being, you know, mentally tough and able to put up with deep fake pornographic videos or images of yourself going around is the main qualification, then talent is not going to be the main qualification. There's going to be a lot of people who will be very talented in politics, presumably younger people as well, who are going to go, I'm not getting into that, and women particularly.
Yeah, I think this is an issue that particularly affects women, and I think not even just in politics. I think any woman in the public eye or even any woman with a large enough following on social media will receive this kind of abuse. I think we weren't prepared for how easily we are contactable on social media, and with the addition of generative AI, like, anything can be put on the table there. And I think something everyone should be looking at is how many of these AI corporations and companies are moving towards explicit content. So Sam Altman announced recently that ChatGPT will allow like an erotic mode where you can presumably chat with the chatbot. All of these things are incredibly worrying to me, and I think for all women. And I think you're right that the more scrutiny and kind of misogynistic abuse that women have to face in the public eye, I mean, it'll stop them going into politics, but it will also stop them putting their views online. It will stop them creating art, kind of all kinds of avenues.
We should acknowledge that the companies, the social media and internet companies, could police this a lot more closely than they do, but they choose not to because
they don't have an interest in policing it because they want your attention and they don't want you to get off the app. So.
Brenda, Gráinne Sóga has been through show business and high profile and all that. She's a tough nut, like, but do you feel sorry for her
reading that? I do, and I think this is actually a very important piece because she says barely one in four TDs in Ireland are female. These figures don't exist in a vacuum. They're part of a product of a system that tells women you need to fit into a very narrow mould here or you're going to be ridiculed. And she said a year on from standing for election, for which she was as qualified, if not more so, than any other candidate, I would say. She has a background in broadcasting communications. She has started her own business. She has a degree in politics. A year on, she is still getting abuse. And she said, I thought if I kept my head down and maintained a dignified silence, it might approach. She said, it hasn't worked.
Keep my head down. What Catherine was saying there.
Exactly. Women have to keep their heads down.
Do you think it does.
I take Pat's point that politicians all have to have a tough hide these days, but that applies to women.
Do you think women have to keep their heads down in general? Is that
if you want
to
avoid
these days?
If you want to avoid that kind of, and I mean, there is no way that what she went through would have been visited on a male candidate. She had to tell her 82-year-old father that this pornographic material featuring her image was circulating online.
I mean, before he heard it from someone else, basically. Okay, and then on the other side of that, Larry, it seems like Jerry the Monk Hutch is not for keeping his head down. The Sunday Indo has this and the Sunday Times have it today. He's 100% committed to running in this by-election.
We'll see. I know he's saying that right now, but we'll see. My own thinking is that, look, he almost caught lightning in a bottle the first time around. He almost pulled off a miracle. I don't think miracles happen twice. I particularly don't think that they're going to happen in the context of a by-election. Yes, of course, there's disenchanted people. There's people who hate the establishment. There's people who give him a tick. But he's not going to be in the running, I wouldn't think, to take a seat in the context of a by-election where only one seat is available. And again, we made a point, good points were made by all the other panelists in terms of politics and where we are and the potential for diminution in quality of candidates. I think this probably points to it in very stark form. But again, I can't see him being competitive in this one. I think to zoom out from and look at the race more broadly, I'd be very surprised. Sinn Féin is well situated there in that constituency. I think they'd view it as a big loss if they don't take a seat. But Hutch's candidacy, I suppose some will get titillation and enjoyment out of it. But the reality is I just don't see him getting anywhere near a seat this time.
Pat, there is a substantial kind of anti-establishment, give them a wallop mood out there at the moment, isn't there?
Oh, there always is.
Yeah. Is it a bit more emboldened right now, though?
Is it? Perhaps you're in the first year of a government, you've had a budget that, you know, was not a flahoolock giveaway like its three previous predecessors. So, yeah, perhaps people are a bit humpier. Certainly the government is less popular. The government parties are considerably less popular than they were just a year ago when they were returned to government. I agree with Larry. Just the maths work differently in a by-election with one seat than with four seats. It'd be very, very difficult for Gerry Hutch to win that election. To do so, he would need transfers. He had difficulty getting transfers. If you remember the count in Dublin Central the last time, how Labour's Marie Sherlock crept up on him, kept getting more transfers.
And he'd need to get votes outside of his own stronghold which is difficult.
I think the Sunday Times piece on it by Claire, John Mooney and Jennifer Bray are saying that it's going to be a fight anyway. First of all, he has the cab, or at least the fact that there's a tax, there is an outstanding tax liability, and he would need to get tax clearance to be able to take a seat once he'd won it. But also there's a quote here from Malachy Steenson, who I suppose would expect to pick up a lot of that anti-government sentiment, saying what's been put in front of people is basically the Hutch gang, an establishment, the establishment or alternatives like me. He said, we were very easy on Hutch in the last election, but 18 people died in my constituency because of a feud he was linked to. If people want to put someone like that in the Dáil, what more can I say? But the gloves will be coming off this time. So he will have a fight on his hands.
Okay. I mean, one thing to say about both those by-elections, or two things perhaps, is that one, I think they will be, the government will be very wary of losing big in both of them, which I think could be a destabilising effect for the government. But the second is, if you look at both constituencies, there are areas in which immigration is likely to be a substantial issue in the by-elections, I think.
Okay.
With all that,
we'll move on to the reason for the Dublin by-election. Catherine Pacifica, did you share in the general shock and upset about Pascal Donoghue leaving this week?
I can't say that I had a particularly emotional reaction, no. But I think something that's been quite interesting is, I suppose, and it's not unique to Ireland, but it does feel like we live in a two-tiered economy. So all of this coverage about, I suppose, a safe pair of hands and the kind of economic stability does feel a bit like it's come at the expense of my generation, where the lack of capital expenditure in terms of like infrastructure and housing has basically, you know, robbed Peter to pay Paul or whatever. And we're paying the price for that now. Like, I think everything that I'm seeing is how good the economy is doing. And I think if you ask anybody of my generation, we're not really feeling the knock-on effects of that, you know, being crushed.
And what about one of the big themes that came up again and again this week, which was one of Pascal Donoghue's big themes, that the centre must hold? Do you and the people you know lionise the idea of centrist kind of almost technocratic politics as much as maybe older people do?
I think what we're seeing, and again, the world over, is young people crying out for people who can speak to the issues that affect them. And I think that goes across the political spectrum, which is why you're seeing people, say, in America, swing from Trump to Mandami. People can't really understand what's going on there, is that we want people who are speaking to us about the cost of living crisis, about the housing crisis, who are trying to guarantee our future. So I think that's affecting politics in a way that people can't really understand. But that's kind of the missing puzzle piece, in my opinion.
OK. Do you see that in Ireland?
People speaking to my generation?
Yeah.
Not particularly, no. I think for a while there it was Sinn Féin, but not really anymore. I think people are struggling to find someone.
Other parties of the left?
I suppose they're not necessarily big enough for people to feel like they're going to have a massive impact. I think there was massive support for Catherine Connolly in my generation because she seemed like somebody who was taking the issues facing us seriously. And I think every kind of policy that I've seen put forward guarantees stability for people who are already existing in stable lives and not guaranteeing stability for us.
Okay. Larry, Shane Ross, these are his words now in the headline, I will stress. Pascal Dunne, who trots off to pastures new while Fine Gael is led by donkeys.
Yeah, I think that's a little bit harsh, perhaps, Shane Ross style, perhaps. But, you know, look, there is. It's interesting to hear Catherine's view, and that view is being articulated by many people on the left. And then people on the right, including, you know, who are saying things like, Pascal really wasn't all that prudent. He spent an awful lot of money. So Pascal is kind of getting it from both sides, while people of the broad middle, perhaps Shane Ross would probably include himself in that, are extolling his virtues in what he did and, you know, kept the show on the road, really, I suppose, would be the line to encapsulate what they feel. In terms of where Fine Gael is now, I think, look, we're going to find out soon what people are made of within Fine Gael. There is this issue of the perception out there that perhaps the heavyweights are all gone now, with the exception perhaps of Simon Harris.
But do you feel that that's fair, Brenda, this notion of, well, he was the last adult in the room. I don't know, people kind of say Micheál Martin was the other adult in the room, but he's a bit damaged now. And
well, funny, Alison O'Connor has a piece in the Sunday Times suggesting that his departure might actually boost Micheál Martin's fortunes because he is now seen as the last safe pair of hands in the cabinet. Interestingly, Ger Colran is kind of taking up the point, Larry, that you were making there, that you know, not everybody is heaping plaudits on Pascal Donoghue. He says that after when prudent Pascal, he said, took a seat in the cabinet in 2014, there were almost 4,000 people in emergency accommodation as he flies to Washington to take up his new €500,000 job with the World Bank, about €300,000 of an increase on what he's been earning. There are just under 17,000 people back in Ireland with no roof over their heads. And he said you'd be inclined to give him a clap on the back if you didn't acknowledge the fact that the areas in which he spent most heavily, infrastructure, healthcare and housing, are the ones where there has been nothing but failure.
Pat, is that fair?
Well, it's not fair to say that there's 17,000 people with no roof over their heads. They don't have their own roof over their heads, but they are.
Is it a fair assessment overall of his, like, you know, a lot of money spent, not that prudent, and what have we got to show for it all?
So I've been thinking about this a fair bit over the week and, you know, the prudent, not prudent Pascal question. And I think the fairest assessment is that on strictly economic terms, and you look at what a lot of economists are saying, they say that, you know, he wasn't all that prudent. You had this vast increase in spending as to what, you know, people get from that. I mean, an awful lot of his expansion of public service, with bigger population and so forth. So he has a record of increasing spending. There was runaway spending increases before last year's election with one-offs and so forth. But that's looking at it from a purely economic point of view. You have to look at it in the political context as well. We interviewed him during the week on our the Irish Times Inside Politics podcast, and he was making the point, which I think is a fair one, which is that, are you seriously suggesting that I should have been running budget surpluses of 15, 16 billion euros every year at a time when there's such public pressure for improvements in services and help with the cost of living? So I think looking at it in the round,
keep throwing money at everything, though, to the exclusion maybe of seeing what value we were getting for that money? Was the answer always more money? We're seeing more top-ups this year on everything into this black box that will gobble up as much money as you'll give it. While services still remain unsatisfactory.
Well, yes, he did. But, you know, there are measurable improvements in some aspects of public services over where they were where they were 10 years ago. As to whether those improvements are sufficient to meet public demand and that. But on the prudence thing, I think the fairest summary is that he was probably more prudent. And I think you have to bear in mind this budget just gone by when he pulled out all the one-offs against some considerable political opposition within government and a clamour from opposition to keep giving many of those one-offs. So I think he was more prudent than any of the alternatives.
He gave a massive wedge to the hospitality industry.
He did,
and it was arguable whether it needed it or not to many people.
I think that's fair, but the final point, Brendan, I think, is that he probably was as prudent as voters would allow him to be. Yeah. Had he been more prudent, I don't think he would be. Had he spent less in the last few budgets, I don't think he would be the outgoing Minister for Finance now, or I don't think he'd be.
Catherine, going back to what you were saying earlier, so we now have a Minister for Finance and a Minister for Public Expenditure who are both under 40. So, you know, the younger generation are getting to take over. Does that give you hope?
Look, it really depends on what their priorities are. I don't think just being youthful necessarily means that you care about the youth, particularly if you're insulated from a lot of the problems that we're facing, you know. I would like to see a shift, but honestly, it might be too little too late, because the type of problems that I was talking about in terms of like maybe the lack of investment in, you know, infrastructure, we're facing these problems from a lack of investment 5 years ago. You start investing now, we're not going to see any kind of payoff for the next 5 years either, you know. So I think, I mean, those kind of investments are often politically unpopular to make because you don't see the benefits immediately, but they're essential.
OK, so go back though to what I was asking. Yeah. I suppose what I'm wondering more is, there is a passing of the torch going on generationally, but does it? Do those kind of people, you know, I don't mean that as a pejorative, but the types who are in politics and who are thriving in politics, even if they are young, are they the type who speak? They don't clearly don't speak probably to the people who got so excited about Catherine Connolly. Do they speak to young people who can't buy houses, to young
people? No, I don't believe they do. And that's kind of what I was saying there. You know, I think it's not even so much as waiting for people of my generation to get into politics, although they are 10 years older than me, you know. But it's what are they actually concerned about? What do they view their voter base as? Who are they actually trying to provide a good life for? And right now, it doesn't really feel like my generation.
But and also to come back to the discussion we had regarding Gráinne Seoige, what is there to encourage people of your generation to enter politics?
Indeed.
In terms of the other aspect of this is Simon Harris taking over. Larry, you looked at Shane Coleman in the Business Post. Pascal's exit leaves the centre without a champion in a left-leaning government.
Yeah, I mean, I think that, and again, take all of Catherine's points are well made, but I think that, yes, Pascal, to follow on from what Pat said, Pascal was as prudent as political circumstances would dictate, in my view. The others, I think, perhaps Simon Harris, but the others, I think, are undeniably to his left, and I think would probably be less cautious or less prone to caution with public expenditure than he is. I think the notion, the traditional notion of Fine Gael being a low-spend, prudent party, I think actions of recent decades really run contrary to that, because they haven't been the party of fiscal rectitude if you look at spending. And again, to go back to something Catherine said there a minute ago about infrastructure and investment, I think that there's going to be a contrary case to that, which is the numerous ominous global clouds lurking out there for Ireland in terms of foreign direct investment and a whole host of other things are going to militate against increased spending.
Okay, so Brenda, the question then is Simon Harris the right man for this job? Or could this actually be the thing that makes a man of Simon Harris?
Yeah, I'm just again going back to Alison's piece. She says she's kind of questioning whether his not-so-inner populist let loose in the Department of Finance could be a reason for concern. She's pointing out the various sort of spendy proposals that he made prior to the budget and is crediting him with the 9% tax.
So he'll be arguing with himself, essentially, here. The prudent side of him will be arguing with the populist side of him in the run-up to a budget.
Indeed. We've yet to see whether he has quite as much a prudent side as Pascal Donoghue did. But, I mean, I think perception is hugely important when it comes to something like this. And you know, back to your earlier questions to whether there's a safe pair of hands or the adults are diminishing in the cabinet. I mean, the perception was certainly that Pascal was a safe pair of hands and that Pascal was a prudent person who was, you know, a details man. He obviously had a degree in financial expertise, which Simon Harris simply doesn't. I mean, he doesn't have a third level degree, arguably.
Most people are not qualified for their
Grainne Scheuder was better
jobs
qualified
in Ireland in any way
for the job that
college wise, like they might be qualified through experience. Just before we leave it, Pat, Owen O'Malley's piece in the Sunday Indo you picked: Harris needs to be less prudent Pascal, more stingy Simon. So back to his populist instincts versus his new role as the person who was supposed to rein in that kind of thing. Is he going to have a kind of a split personality issue?
It's certainly, I mean, look, I suppose if Simon Harris were here, he were here, he would argue that, you know, he was there for a budget, he was involved in budget negotiations.
Yeah, but the job of a party leader, everyone is saying, is to push the finance minister to loosen the purse strings a bit more.
Well,
the job of the finance minister is to hold tough on that.
In order for his party to be more popular, to do popular things like spend the money on public services and giveaways and tax cuts and that people
like. You can be stingy but popular.
I suppose if you look at what finance ministers tend to try and do, they tend to try and be a little bit stingy in the early part of a term, and when an election looms, then they get less stingy and more populist. So it would be a really interesting process to watch the next budget with Simon Harris. I think that would be where we can really judge him.
It really will. Okay, we'll take a break. Catherine Pacifica, Larry Donnelly, Brenda Power and Pat Lee, he's still with us. Welcome back, Catherine Pacifica, Larry Donnelly, Brenda Power and Pat Lee, he's still with us. Brenda, you're writing about this yourself as well today, but you picked Eilidh O'Hanlon's piece today. How do you solve a problem like Enoch? Well, first you need to find him.
Well, yes, and Eilidh is pointing out that somebody online said if the guards are looking for him, maybe try outside Wilson's Hospital.
Yeah,
maybe?
Just a hunch, yeah.
Which is where apparently he popped up on Saturday to record a video outlining his setting out his stall once again. But although he has, I think that order was made on Tuesday, the committal order, they have not yet managed to execute it. So I presume that's only a matter of time. But I suppose the question I was raising as well was like, you know, what a missed opportunity, I guess, in a way that he had for this particular issue, because I think a lot of people would be inclined to agree with basically his concern about using pronouns for young children. I know the CAS report came out the same year that this issue blew up and basically confirmed that this was not a neutral act. And I mean, the tide does seem to be turning against trans ideology. If you look at the UK Supreme Court ruling last April, the fact that increasing numbers of countries are now banning puberty blockers, the IOC moving to ban biological males basically from female sport. But the way he has conducted himself has been a gift to his opponents, and you cannot possibly have any sympathy for him for the position he finds himself in. It seems to me a shame that this matter wasn't handled maybe in a different way early on, but I completely
accept. In what way?
Well, mediation maybe. I don't know if that was tried or if there was any prospect of it 2 years ago, 3 years ago, but I cannot see what alternative the judge had when he spoke of Mr. Burke's kind of ungovernable anger, his lack of self-control, his aggression. And I mean, when you get somebody being aggressive to judges in the High Court and the Court of Appeal, I think, you know, it is legitimate to say how that you, to have concerns about how that person might behave around other pupils and teachers.
Yeah. So you're saying he clearly is this particular type of person, as outlined by the judge, who seems to lack control over his anger and who seems to speak, and the judge pointing out as well that basically he is in his own moral certainty, he is right and everyone else is wrong and everything. I kind of wonder, if you go back then to the original nub of this about him refusing to use the child's preferred term, would there not be room for a bit of kindness there on his behalf in that situation?
Of course.
We can all have our principles and everything else, but like in that situation, in the school, go along.
It can't
and
be the
kind.
Only school this has arisen in. It is surely not the only school.
It's
and
not.
Other schools
but you know
have
what,
it.
Brenda? I don't think we hear about it in lots of
no,
schools.
No, we don't.
Because I think,
people
I
deal
think
with
often
it.
People are very good at dealing with it, and I think teenagers are very good at dealing with it as well.
I agree. Absolutely. And I mean, from the outset, this did not need to cause the problems that it did. But had he said, look, I am a Catholic, I'm a Christian, and this goes against my beliefs, I think there would have been people who would have supported him too.
Can I jump in there and just say that I don't actually think being pro-trans is being anti-Catholic. I think respecting the basic human dignity of every single living person is a core tenet of Christianity, and I think that extends to trans people as well. I think healthcare extended to trans kids and respect extended to trans kids can be life-saving in many cases, and I think trans rights are human rights that need to be respected, and I would like to say that.
It can also be deeply damaging.
Yes, of course
them
it can. Especially
I suppose
when
the balance that that you have to struggle with.
Especially
I
when
suspect
into
one of the reasons
early.
Why there hasn't been, we haven't heard about this in more schools or workplaces, whatever, is because people who have, as Brenda outlines in her column today, people who have serious questions or reservations about transition particularly for teenagers don't want to speak up because they'll be labelled as Enoch Burke supporters. Yeah. I think he's done a grave disservice to the sceptical type.
Do you think
side
people
of the
are afraid to speak up though?
Yes, 100%. People are terrified to speak up. You see that. I hear that all the time. People saying, you know, I agree with you if I've ever written on this issue, but, you know, don't use my name. I can't say this in public.
How is it affecting those people?
How do you mean those people
the,
are?
The people who are afraid, who feel strongly about this and want to speak up. How is it, the people who get onto you, how is it affecting their lives?
Well, I mean, I think, you know, coming back to a point that actually Ivan Yates made during the week, he said, if we're all singing off the same hymn sheet, and if the media and politics operates in a bubble, you're driving people to alternative...
We have two pieces about this
issue. Yes, I know.
One by Eilish O'Hanlon and one by you.
You're on national radio talking about it right now.
But
I don't think you're being silenced.
A year ago, you wouldn't have had this discussion. Brandon.
Okay, so do you think that I would probably dispute that in the sense that I think we do probably not have a discussion about the heart of this issue, as in the whole, you might call it, what is a woman, unless there is a trans person present, because I think that a lot of them would feel, don't debate my existence without me being there. And I think that we have done that, but you can't always do it in this situation. On a Sunday, this is probably a peripheral issue to it and a broader discussion. So, like, we are having it. Catherine, what do you think?
I think.
Would you agree, for example, with what Pat and Brenda both said, that it can be that it's now been kind of ascertained, really, scientifically and medically, that it can be damaging for children to just go along with it?
Sure, yeah. But I think ultimately, say, things like socially transitioning can be incredibly beneficial as well. I think we need to actually look at the reality of trans people and their lived experience and how difficult it is. I mean, trans people die by suicide at a far higher rate than many people because they're not receiving any kind of gender-affirming care or respect, right? And I really want to push back against the idea that there is a silent majority here who are just being silenced, and that's why we're not hearing from them. I think you're correct to point out, if people feel they are being silenced, what is the material harm that is being enacted upon them other than not being able to express their views about what a woman is or isn't? We need to look at the actual effect on the mental health of people and how damaging that is to them. I don't agree.
Would you agree, Brenda? It's a hard road for a kid, It's a hard road for a family, for their parents, for everyone, isn't it?
Of course it is. But when you are edging towards a situation where offering those children counselling rather than medication is considered to be, illegal, that it is, that there's...
I don't think anyone is pushing to not have counselling for children.
Well, I think there is. Ask people like Stella O'Malley whether they have been supported in their calls primarily for people to be counselled when they come in and say age 5, 6 or 7. Now, there was a very interesting debate on the Times radio last week between Helen Joyce and Helen Weberley. And they are poles apart, both sides on this. But I mean, basically, I suppose the point where I'm coming from and where I say that people's views should be respected and they should be allowed to express them is in relation to women's safe spaces. That you cannot have males coming into women's refuges, into women's prisons, into women's changing rooms. You just can't. And that is a biological reality.
Do you think that addressing a child in school by their preferred pronouns is the start of a continuum that ends
up? I think it could well be. That's certainly what the Cass report found.
I really don't think that the idea of safe spaces for women should be weaponized against trans women. Trans women are women. Men do pose a threat to women sometimes. Cis men.
Males pose a threat to women. And according to that debate, apparently 88% of trans women are fully intact men. Fully intact males.
I really don't see what that places where has women to are do vulnerable. With this.
I do.
What makes me a woman?
No, you know what? That's exactly what I said. I just think it's unfair to get into that discussion without having a trans
person. I just asked the question, Brenda was saying, was asserting what is... Like, she's already having the debate.
Well, I think we would know that Brenda would agree that, but... Biology would make a person a woman. You would disagree.
Well, I'll just say equally, I'm not going to
sit here and conduct a debate about the existential nature of what a trans person is without there being a trans person. I would like to put forward the idea that debate was already happening.
I fully agree with you, but as I'm speaking now on radio as a disembodied voice, people do not know what my biology is, but they would still recognise me as a woman.
Okay. I'm not moving away from that to avoid it or anything. I'm moving away because I think we've had a good airing of views on it and everything. Larry, let's get into another contentious issue, migration. So Leo Varadkar has an interesting piece in the Sunday Times today. The headline is "We can't pretend asylum laws exist in a vacuum." But what he is saying is, we need to have an informed conversation around this.
Yeah, I think that's true. And there's a number of pieces in the papers outlining that same thing. A lot of this brought to the fore by the new stricter regulations being brought into force in the United Kingdom and people in within government and others saying that, look, we are going to need to tighten things up because there's no question that there could potentially be a lot more people coming here seeking asylum on the basis of stricter laws in the UK and this idea for potentially to harmonize them. And again, I'm somebody who loves to give people a shot. I'm pro-immigration, but I don't think the government has much of a choice in this regard. The system is creaking as it is. So I do think that this is inevitable, that tighter laws are going to come into play. But just one broader thing on the immigration issue, and we hear constantly two things that are said. One is that the number of overall, in terms of international protection seekers, they are a tiny sliver of the immigrants coming into the country. The other thing we are hearing is that we need a lot of people to do jobs and hospitality and all sorts of other things, high tech, et cetera. We need these people to come in here. Otherwise, the economy, the healthcare system wouldn't function. Those are both true. And I think that most people would acknowledge them readily. Yet still, they are deeply uneasy about the rate of immigration and the time in which it has happened. And that is where the unease comes about. And I think that that picture is being missed. There are very, very many people here who say two things when it comes to immigration. And these may be technically racist, but the people who are saying them, I actually don't think are racist. But they're saying, number one, where are we going to house them? We don't have enough places for, so to speak, our own. That is, people who are born here. The second thing is that they're looking around the areas and communities that they grew up in, and because of the scale and the speed of the change and the rate of immigration, they're looking around saying, I don't really recognize this place anymore. It doesn't look like the place I grew up in.
And
there's an awful lot of that.
Are you veering a bit close to the notion of an island of strangers now? I mean, everywhere is changing all the time. The Ireland I grew up in is long gone.
That's absolutely true.
I'm
not articulating a personal view.
Yeah.
I'm articulating what I hear constantly over and over and over again from
Catherine, people. Do you understand people who would think that?
I have been very disturbed, I think, by the recent conversations around migration. And I think they have been at times careless and at times dangerous, because I think, yes, there probably are discussions to be had. There is a small but vocal minority of voices who are hiding behind the guise of being immigration skeptic, and they're just racist. And I think we need to call that out at every possible opportunity.
Like,
There's a strong majority. If you put any question in,
I don't know if it's small and vote. Like, to take one example, there was a poll in the Sunday Independent a few weeks ago, and I think roughly that, no, it's a snapshot in time, but 80% of people in that poll had problems with how the government is handling migration.
So what I'm speaking of, though, is, I suppose, a narrative shift that I've noticed and I've actually been the victim of, where the fact that I am the child of an immigrant has never once affected my life in Ireland whatsoever. More recently online, I've had people in my DMs saying I should be deported, calling me a Slavic pig, saying that I'm not really Irish, right? Because of my surname. I've noticed this in particular. These are people who are not concerned about the nitty-gritty of the immigration detail. They're not concerned about whether or not you're here legally. They're not concerned about whether or not you're an economic migrant or you're a refugee.
But those people are not represented in this country.
That's why I said they're
the
small, but I think they're quite vocal. And I think they came out with the Spoil the Vote campaign in places, and you see them online, and I think they're having an outsized impact on our discourse.
Do they have an outsized impact, do you think, Brenda?
I think they probably do, yeah. I think that these protests, when local communities attempt to express legitimate reservations about the changing nature of their communities, that they tend to be weaponized. That they do tend to be weaponized, and you often see in response to that that the locals come in and saying, well, you know, you don't represent us, and tackling these people in front of, you know, when the cameras are there. But I don't agree that anybody who expresses, I think that seems to be a bit of a left wing narrative, that anybody who expresses reservations about migration and the levels of immigration is automatically far right. I think and that is a very, very dangerous narrative, and is pushing people into the arms of those particular groups.
And Pat, I think that what the mainstream of politics is now trying to do is pull people from the arms of those groups by maybe moving slightly more towards a kind of a what might have been traditionally thought of as a more right-wing position on migration.
Yeah, I think that's fair enough. I mean, let's not forget that we had democratic measurements of all this last year, when we had a general election and we had local and European elections. In the general election, not a single overtly right-wing anti-immigration candidate was elected. In the local elections, out of about 900 councillors, there was a handful of them elected. So this is a small minority. What is not a small minority, however, is the numbers of people who have concerns. And that's a spectrum, but they have concerns about the levels of immigration. And if there's one outstanding lesson of European politics for the last 10 years, it's that voters want tougher immigration laws. They want fewer people from other countries coming into their country. Now, we might not like that. I don't like it. But it is a fact. Just because we don't like it doesn't mean that it's not true. And the message
is that people want the system to work better, and then probably allied to that, they do not want their country to look like a soft touch.
Yeah, well, they're not looking like a soft touch thing, I suppose, is another level beyond about how you manage those numbers and how you communicate. And this is what governments, including the Irish government, are doing. The British government was doing it during the week, about sending out messages to would-be migrants not to come to them. But to go back to what European electorates have been saying to their political establishments is, if you do not reduce migration levels, then we will elect somebody who will. And we see that all across Europe. And again, we may not like this, but that's the fact.
Is it the fact, Catherine, actually, even if you don't like it?
Well, I think what happens here is when you have a far-right narrative and you have the more centrist parties kind of capitulate at least a bit to that narrative, what that does is it shifts the Overton window and suddenly these things become fair game. And I've seen this online myself, where after Simon Harris's statements about migration, I've seen many, many people say, well, you know, you called me a racist 2 months ago, it's a step in the right direction, thanks for, you know...
For him saying it's too high.
Yeah, and they're...
What was wrong with that? I'm just saying, what was wrong with saying it's too high?
I feel like the debate, as I said, it's being framed by this narrative already and entering into the debate in a way that is maybe a little bit careless. Like, these people see that and they say, tick, I'm correct. That's what I've been saying the whole time, right? So I think those statements needed a lot more care. I think ultimately what we've seen is, and the way far-right parties have gotten in across Europe, is you shift the Overton window. But why would people vote for the centre when there's people on the far right who've been saying the thing that they've been wanting them to say the whole time, right? You see those parties get into government that way, and I'm quite concerned about that.
Well, I think that's why.
I would disagree that they're capitulating to the far right. What I do believe that they are responding to is what they're hearing from their constituents. And what their constituents are saying, again, they're not anti-immigrant. Most of them would say, we welcome immigration. But this is all happening very, very fast. Let's press a little bit of a pause button here and get a handle on things. That's where, in my view, of that 80% figure you mentioned, the vast majority of that 80%, they're somewhere in that nebulous realm of, hold on a second here, let's just cool the jets a bit. That's where I think...
Brenda, you want to come back in there before we leave this?
No, I was just saying that listening to analysis of the new British Home Secretary's Mahmood's proposals, that basically the Labour refuseniks, and obviously there is a lot of resistance within a party to some of the proposals, they're basically being told, if we don't do this, Nigel Farage will. And I mean, I think that is what the fear in the UK is. And you know, we do not exist in a vacuum when it comes to UK immigration policy. So obviously...
No, we are very, very downstream.
We have to react to it.
Yeah. Okay. We'll take a break. Catherine Pacifica, Larry Donnelly, Brenda Power and Pat Lee, he's staying with us. Welcome back. Catherine Pacifica, Larry Donnelly, Brenda Power and Pat Lee, he's still with us. Larry, obviously it's all going on around Ukraine today. Just give us a picture of where we're at and where you think this might go. I think we're shifting slightly, are we, from the notion that, okay, here's Putin's shopping list, Ukraine can't agree to this, more to a space of, well, maybe there is wriggle room here and maybe this is something that Ukraine might need to consider doing at this point.
Yes, I think first we need to note the bizarre, I suppose, disconnect between what Marco Rubio said to a group of United States senators, which was, this was delivered to us, this isn't our plan, and now he's saying, actually, it is our plan.
But so this is crazy.
It's mad. And it's, again, a lot of, you know, trying to follow the moves of the Trump administration is extraordinarily difficult at the best of times, never mind when it comes to something so complex as this. But at any rate, we do have today happening meetings in which the Europeans are involved for the first time, which I think is a welcome development. And evidently what their objective is to push back a little bit on this plan and say, look, this is too generous in basic terms to Russia, both in terms of territory, in terms of demands to reduce the size of Ukraine's army, that in every way this is unacceptable. But to your point in the question, I do think we are moving on this. I do think that that Ukraine is in a difficult position right now. The fact is there's a domestic political corruption scandal, which Zelensky is under huge pressure about anyway. And there are other issues going on here in terms of how long can Ukraine keep fighting and keep losing individuals, where we know the Russian army is adding 30,000 new members every single month. How long can Ukraine keep fighting? And Zelensky's in this position already, and Trump is saying that, look, if you don't go along with this, you can go fight your little heart out. So as Zelensky is framing this, he's almost saying, look, either we lose our most important ally or we capitulate and humiliate ourselves. Neither one of those is a good option, but I do think the discussion is moving in a certain direction because of realities on the ground, realities that none of us like, because we're all with Ukraine on this. I think most of us are. But some of the realities are coming back to bite, and they're putting Zelensky in an impossible position where capitulation might, at the end of the day, be the only chance.
Pat, do you get the sense that is Europe starting to wish this was over as well and maybe willing to kind of move a bit on their hard lines about it? Or are we still in that position of we cannot give an inch to the Russians because they're conducting this hybrid war right across the continent, and if we give an inch here, then, you know, it's curtains to all of us. It's giving Czechoslovakia to Hitler.
I mean, I think everybody wishes it was over, but I think it depends on who you talk to across Europe. Obviously, if you're talking to people in Western Europe, then the Russian threat is less visceral to them, less immediate, less threatening to them in a way. But you talk to people from Poland and from the Baltic countries, places in Central and Eastern Europe, and they very much see Ukraine as the front line, and that if Russia is not stopped in Ukraine, then it will have to be stopped. It will have to be stopped somewhere else. They, as to where it goes, I think in public, you will certainly see EU leaders repeat the lines that say, you know, this cannot be agreed without Ukraine. We will support Ukraine. No deal that is unacceptable to Ukraine will be acceptable to us. In private, I think that they're likely to, while they will commit assistance to military and other assistance to Ukraine indefinitely, the scale of what they are able and willing to commit will not match the void created by the withdrawal of United States support, if that's what happens. And so in private, I think that they are likely to push Zelensky to accept, unpalatable as it may be, some sort of a land for peace deal. Now, the two sticking points, I think, would be both the extent of the territory that is sought for Putin under this peace deal. I think it would be a very difficult sell for Zelensky to give up territory that the Russians have not yet conquered.
Whereas, and like also a lot of the people limits in Ukraine seem to have accepted that they're giving up the territory that Russia has conquered.
The prospects of getting that back seem to be pretty remote. The other thing then is about the levels of the Ukrainian army. I mean, you've talked to people in Brussels about this, and what they talk about is in a post-conflict scenario where Ukraine has lost territory but is essentially made into what they call a sort of a military porcupine, armed to the teeth, that would, with US and European assistance, that would deter any future Russian action against Ukraine.
Yeah. But then there are other people who argue that 600,000 is actually quite a substantial army, and that the peacetime force in Ukraine was 250,000, in fact, and you are going to have a demilitarized zone there as well. Anyway, a couple of more things I want to get to before the end. Catherine, Sunday Times, Katie Balls, she says Trump's biggest problem isn't Epstein, it's the AI bubble. You're quite exercised about this.
Well, I mean, I think they're both problems for him. But yeah, I think, I mean, like I was saying about a two-tier economy in Ireland, I think that definitely exists in the States, where these AI companies are contributing massively to the stock market, and there's no way for them to continue scaling the way they are, because they're simply limited by the chips and resources available, and it's causing huge issues in terms of water prices, energy prices in communities. And I think it's about to pop, and that will obviously also have knock-on effects for us as well if these tech companies end up.
Okay. Look, the head of NVIDIA during the week and other people involved are saying, no, not a bubble, this is a boom. But before we go, Brenda, we should remember Paul Costello, Ireland's Ralph Lauren, as they're calling him. Like, this is a guy from Dublin who was a player in international fashion long before J.W. Anderson or any of that.
Absolutely. He was Princess Diana's personal designer from 1983 until she died. Apparently one of her ladies-in-waiting spotted his fashions and realised that they would suit her. And that was one of, I suppose, a big feather in his cap and made him a player in global fashion. But he seemed to be a great character. I never actually met the man, but he seemed to be a great character as well, because I do remember about 10 years ago he said that Irish women wouldn't know style if it teetered up to them on 10 inch heels, and he said most of us are only a couple of generations out of the bog, and sure, what could you expect? And you know, he's right about that, really.
Well, yeah, I think he was a bit of a wind-up merchant as well, in fairness. Like, I mean, he was a salesman ultimately, and I think he said somewhere today, look, that made me a celebrity, and what are you going to do?
Right.
Okay, thanks very much to my excellent panel this morning, Catherine Pacifica, Larry Donnelly, Brenda Power, and Pat Leahy, and it's just after 12 noon, and we'll go to the newsroom.